Kishore, what's going on, man?
It's going good. Nice to meet you, Joe. Yeah.
Yeah. Good to see you again. I think the last time we saw each other was in Boston a couple months ago. So
yes. Yeah. And I had you in one of my classes as well as a guest lecturer. So that was really great as well. Yeah,
that's a lot of fun. We can get into that. I guess, do you want to give a quick intro to people who don't know who you are?
Sure. I'm Kishore Adia. I have been in the data space for a long time, but been in this space for almost 25 years, wearing various hats, leading data science, data analytics, data management teams, led search back when monster.com was a thing. Worked at different organizations like Bose, Stanley Black & Decker, Adobe, and a whole host of other things. So I've been in the data e-commerce side of it as well. So a whole bunch of areas. As I said, I've seen the entire gamut of it. Worked across large organizations, small startups. Multiple hats. Yeah.
I think we're riffing on that too. When we were in Boston, it seemed like you were sort of one of the OGs of the Boston data scene back in the day.
Oh, I wouldn't go. a lot of great people there, but yes.
Yeah, a lot of great people there. Yeah. But a lot of good genesis from some of the companies you're at. So
absolutely. Yeah. And this is where one of the original Scrum creators started back in the days.
Oh, really?
With Ken Schwaber. I think he was, at least at that point, he was local to the area, but I don't know if he still is or not. But both of them, they started here, the whole thing.
Interesting. You have a long track record in this industry. And I always like to ask this of people who have been in the industry for a while, like what keeps you going? There's a million other things you could probably be doing. Like why are you interested in data? What keeps you going in this field?
Yeah, it's a good question in the sense that I've always been interested in this field. I've started my career and my education in the computer science. I've been in this quote unquote what they call these days. There's lots of different variations of that, AI and all that. But I've been in this space for a long time, and I've always been interested in the algorithmic approaches to looking at it, in the core computer science approach to building capabilities, building our software capabilities around that. And I kind of have been on the journey, as you will, and data, especially in the last decade or so that I've been kind of focused on, is one of those interesting things where when you look back on it, data has always been there. It's like, think of it as the business exhaust, right? I think we heard different terminologies to talk about that. But now the focus is kind of gravitating, as it's been gravitating towards it for a long time, but now it's kind of really taking on a different form, especially with the explosive growth within the LLM, within the generative AI, within the AI space. But then the funny thing is, it's been around for a while. It's been around for decades. Now the combinatorial piece of data, computation, and this, they're all taking on a different form. So there's always something new. There's always something exciting. I never felt like I really work every day. I'd come in, I'd do different things. Yeah. I never felt like it's work. I always find there's something new to learn from, etc.
That's super cool. I feel the same way. It just becomes sort of routine. I'm not sure how it is for you, but it's like, feels like it's just it's a part of you at some point.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Like, And every day there's something to learn, and I'm always an extremely, always been very curious about learning, going down rabbit holes, unfortunately, as we all tend to do in different things. But there's always so much going on, and it humbles you to think about the things that are still unknown. I'm like, I got to know that. I got to know more of that. And then you realize, oh, there's more to that. And so it's like almost unwrapping like a gift toy. It keeps on unwrapping and unwrapping. It's like one of those things. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And it's interesting. There's just so many avenues to learn, right? And to look at it. I think the more I know, I feel like the less I know. I'm not sure.
Exactly.
About you.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. It's the same thing. I'm like, there's so much to this. And you're like, your tiny little thing, your thought process, you think you know, but you realize that you know only tiny little, this little sliver over here kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like the other day, I was just chatting with my friend Jessica Talisman, right? And she's more in the library sciences area, but, I mean, that's a whole new area I never really explored, right? So she had me go get she suggested I get the book, The Accidental Taxonomist, and read that. And I was like, okay, that's an area that I'm need to add to the, you know, to the stack. But it's like, man, yeah, you're absolutely right. It just, it never ends. And again, the more you get into it, the more you realize that there's more to keep going. So balance this out though, right? So you're also a professor, and you're also naturally curious, and you seem self-motivated in learning. How do you balance all these things together, right? Because when you're teaching, you obviously have to narrow down on a subset of things that you're going to be teaching to students, but at the same time, balancing it against, I think, your natural inclination to, at least push yourself. Like, how do you decide what to teach?
So this teaching is something that I just picked up, you know, almost a little bit over a year ago. And part of the natural inclination for me has always been throughout my career, I love to try to learn and explain and try. And part of that comes to, I've always been greatly admiring of Richard Feynman, for example, his technique of explaining things, breaking it down to the lowest common denominator and using terminologies, using words that a 12-year-old or a 14-year-old can understand, and not necessarily use words as short circuit to assume that others know. And in a lot of the times, it's not the name, but it's what is it behind that, right? So to me, I've always been fascinated with that approach to thinking about it. And so this teaching avenue, if you will, gives me an opportunity to help break things down. So when I go through with my students, I always, you know, I think you were there, part of my class, one of the classes as well, we always go down to the first principles. Really, you know, when we talk about all the other things, when you talk about governance, talk about data engineering, we talk about all these different aspects to that, again, it all comes down to some basic things. You got to have some good, solid, for example, good, solid data quality, right? Good quality, garbage. I know that we hear about all the time, but the students, they get, get caught up with all the different things. And then it all comes down to that is some basics. And you and I, we've talked about this in the past as well. It all comes down to the basic core, like, for example, data modeling. Like, a lot of those folks don't think about data modeling as an important thing. But I'm saying it's such a fundamental piece to that. To everything. So that's what kind of drives that thinking and learning, and then kind of exploring it, and then kind of, you know, expanding on it and kind of really building up on top of that.
Yeah, that's interesting. When you work with students, I mean, you bring up an interesting point. What are some of the first things that you notice that students are interested in that maybe you wish they weren't interested in?
Yeah, that's an interesting one, because almost always, right, when they look at what they're bombarded with, hey, look at this cool, I'm just not picking on large language models or anything. There's always something new. There's always something new that comes along, right? If it's not this, it's something else. So they're always so enamored by, oh, look at this cool thing that it can do. Or look at this, you know, this API I can call this, can do this wonderful thing with it. Without truly unpacking it and understanding the nuances under the covers, like, for example, you know, one of the things I do is to spend some good amount of time trying to understand, like, let's look at transformers. Like, how did it, like, for example, how did this transformer approach take place? Somebody just didn't get up in the morning and decide, hey, I'm going to come up with this wonderful, you know, approach to doing it. No, but look at the historical nature of that. So what I do with the class is to kind of go through some of the papers, some of the core papers that are built up on that. And I always talk about this. Everything started at some point, somewhere. Somebody started off with one little iota of a thought process, and then that's been built up over the years, over the decades in terms of that. So we go back to the word to vec paper, just to give us some starting point to say, here's some of those things come up with it. So now the students themselves come back to me and say, oh, I didn't realize that this particular paper over here is what is being used in a scaled up way, of course, but that's the core thing that's being used in a different way. And when people develop things and do things, they use different approaches to doing it. Somebody else must have thought about some other paper. Let's try this. At the end of the day, everybody's trying out, experimenting different things. Nobody really, some know, some people have good intuition about where this might go, but nobody really knows, right? We all try out different things, and then it comes up, oh, yeah, sure. the whole OpenAI genesis, when you heard from Sam Altman say, everybody kind of like, it's not going to work. this is not going to happen. You just throw data and it's not going to do what it's going to do. But yet here we are. So again, you don't know.
Yeah, you don't know. What I find interesting too is there's a ton of research papers right now.
Yes.
It seems like, especially the AI space, I can't keep track. I don't think anyone can. Maybe an AI model could. I don't know. But how do you know what to focus on or pay attention to in the sea of what it feels like is rapidly increasing noise? How do you find that signal in all that noise?
Like for example, just to kind of hone in on one thing, and then we can expand on that. Let's look at, for example, the RAG architecture, right? That's the flavor of the current period of time, right? For lack of a better word. Mm-hmm. Now, when you take that and then you see a whole bunch of papers that are being written about that in so many different ways. Okay, can we use this for example, can you apply that with KG applying to that, knowledge graphs applied to that, just one example of that. And then there is different ways to slice and dice it, with different way to chunk this, different ways to do that, use this. So again, all of these papers that are being written against the core basic, you know, RAG architecture model that came out, like, you know, expounded a few years ago, came out in a paper. So always go back to the original paper, the OG paper, if you like to say. Yep. Here's where the concept first originated. Now, everything else, all the other papers, all the other thought process, they're all, you know, built off of this one thing, right? That's kind of where we go back to that. Otherwise, what's going to happen is, to your earlier point, there are so many areas that your mind can gravitate to. Oh, somebody comes out with almost like, you know, there's like dozens of papers that gets published on archive, like almost every day, right?
Every day.
Every day. Humanly, it's not possible. So what you can do is to at least go back to the basic principle, saying, okay, is this a variation of this principle? Or is this a variation of this core approach to doing it? If that is the case, then that particular paper, or that particular avenue, or is there any particular use case that you're working on? Is there any particular kind of area that you're focused on, task that you're working in? Is there any particular kind of business area or business focus area that you're working on? If it is, then is that worthwhile for you to explore that path that somebody has taken down the path? So those are some of the variables, if you will, to make sense of it, and not to necessarily follow through everything that gets created. Otherwise, yeah, you're just going to go crazy, just not think all the way through.
How do you convey this back to your students, right? Because I think if I try and put myself in the shoes of a student, it's like I have to take this class, Kishore's teaching it, and he's going to teach me stuff maybe, you know, but I also have this curiosity and maybe a bit of FOMO as well. Like I feel like I'm learning data engineering, for example, in the class that, you know, I participated in with you, but there's all this other stuff that I want to learn because I feel like maybe, you know, that's what I need to learn. But how do you convey to students like how they should approach extracurricular learning? Because I mean, if you and I have a hard enough time doing it, I can only imagine that students have an infinitely more confusing time in this area. So
yeah, they are really concerned about it because they feel that they don't quite know. And so one of the things that I try to tell them is, what are your passion? There's so many things that you can get caught up in. Are there any specific areas that gets you excited? That's really kind of feel like, oh, this is a thing that I really want to. For example, right now I'm, you know, over the last while I'm focused on knowledge graphs. Just use one example of that, right? Saying, okay, I'm really interested in this area because I feel that this can help me in this particular focus, whatever the focus that you're working towards, right? It doesn't matter. It could be a pet project. It could be something that you're working on and looking at the existing RAG and like, hey, this is not going to help me out with that. So whatever that is, whatever your passion point is, a passion area is, focus on that and then figure out what are the different areas that goes around it. And to your question, they come to me and they say, hey, you're teaching data engineering. And I say, well, look, it's not just data, it's data engineering at the core, but in application, for example, in the context of large language model, in the context of knowledge graph. That's a separate class that I'm teaching. Again, data engineering, but in the context of knowledge graphs.
That's
so
cool.
There is some core thing to that, but there are different areas of focus, if you will, right? Because data there's a coreness to everything that you do. It's not like as if it's you go off and do something completely different. It's how you apply that in the context of that. And so when the students come to me, like, I want to do this and do this, I'm like, okay, here's what I'm doing. And by the way, as I bring in some guest speakers in, I will combine some of these things so it allows you to get to see that aspect of it as well. So you get some aspects to that, so you don't get caught up in, I want to do this, 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 and this. No. Focus on core, and then you can figure out how you can expand on your knowledge once you have that coreness to it. That's how I kind of try to get them to see that, so they don't feel that they're missing out on it. It's natural. It's human nature, like for us as well, right? I mean, look at things. Oh, I want to do this. I want to do this. I want to do that. You can't do everything. But what can you do is focus on the coreness and then expand on that as you can go to.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned knowledge graphs too. Let's talk about that. This seems to be sort of the other topic du jour in the data world these days is you had LLMs, you had data engineering and all this other fun stuff. But knowledge graphs, they seem to be capturing a lot of attention. No pun intended, I guess, for the transporter. But yeah. Walk me through that. Like, what, you know, I think before we started recording, you said you have a deep interest in knowledge graphs. So explain to the audience, like, what are knowledge graphs and what's their utility with respect to modern data practices today?
Like, when you look at the history of how the current relational model, the set theory, the algebraic notation to that, like, all came into existence, right? If you go back to one of the original seminal papers of that came out, it was back in the 60s, late 50s or 60s. One of the things that actually was noted in that particular thing was this concept of relationships being, shall we say, as a first-class citizen at the same level as everything else that you think about. And the part of the problem was, at that time, this kind of a creation, an understanding of it, was really, really hard because there were no computational, shall we say, horsepower to help support that, right? To help support this knowledge graph to be looked. Everybody knew that, okay, we needed to fashion how the world, physical world operates. Yeah. Like, for example, the relationship that you and I have or relationships with a bunch of other people have, and I own this property, you own another property, and by the way, we own similar things. And so there's all kinds of connection. At the end of the day, everything is connected in some way, shape, or form, right? So when you look at that wider perspective of it, how do you take that physical world and map it to a digital world, right? And map it to the computational world? How do you do that? So, hence, again, this whole, you know, normalization, the whole relational set there, I don't want to go deep into that. But I'm saying that everybody knows that. That's how you take that, you normalize it, you take this particular thing, you create this rule, you create this, you know, XRF table, bunch of things that you do in order to mimic this world and map it to this world, right? That's kind of what you're trying to do there. Mm-hmm. So in a natural, but then to do that, you needed to have the right kind of computational capability, meaning that you needed to have the right kind of support, the computational systems, in order to execute on that, to implement that, to get it done. Now, what happens is, with knowledge graph, it is compute intensive at the end of the day. It's not necessarily the most, it doesn't lend itself. Knowledge, it doesn't lend itself to that. But yet, everybody knew the graphs. Everybody knew the graph theory that's been around since Euler, since around 1700. The point is that everybody knew that this was the natural way in which people used to draw, like stick figures.
Yeah.
Okay, here I am. I'm connected to you. Here's who you are, right? So intuitively, as humans, we get that. That's how we represent things. Nobody represents things in terms of relational model, right? We talk about nobody's going to put things in tables. Nobody's going to put things in the... That's not how naturally humans think.
Yep.
But yet, it has not... And that's where my interest, where I think, comes from, right? So you create this now. And then with the advancement in the computational side of it and with the notion of using context, semantics, how do you do that? And especially with the growth of the computation behind networks, behind neural networks, behind all these different capabilities. Now you're going to see, especially with companies, I don't want to pick on one or the other, but the different companies like Neo4j, amongst many others, TigerGraph, you get a whole bunch of other companies that are trying to build up on that capability, right? And so now the computation side of it has become a lot less expensive, a lot more easier to do it. And that's kind of how it's going to come to the fore. Now you're able to represent nodes and edges, graphs. Again, as I said, this graph theory goes back a long time. Nothing new there. But now how do you take those different pieces to it? And how do you create properties? How do you create those things? How do you create those edges? Again, there needs to be some level of convergence in the knowledge graph world, just like the way in the SQL world, like you got the ANSI SQL, right, to do that. Whereas in the graph world, there are a couple of different, there are two or three different ways in which you do Cypher, and then there's SparkQL. There's a bunch of other mechanisms, right, in which you can get to traverse the graphs and things to do that. I think there will be some level of convergence that's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Seems like it. Yeah. I mean, what was it? My friend One Cicada had some research out beyond the impact of knowledge graphs and LLMs, and lo and behold, they provide a lot more context to large language models. And I don't know. It seems like the graph community it seems in general that the conversations are back with a vengeance. I'm not sure if it's the LLM sort of facilitated this, or maybe because data modeling is getting a second look for the 50 millionth time. I mean, when you teach this out to students, like, how do they respond to it? Do they feel like, does the topic make sense to them, or do you feel like it's maybe a bit of a foreign concept to them?
To be honest, that class is my first iteration of that class, and I have a relatively small number of students compared to my other class. And I think that reflects, it's still, the community is still in its nascent stages, meaning that there are pockets of people who are really in it, who really understand that, who see the value of it. And I think it's going to grow. But right now, I still feel that it's still in the nascent, especially from an academic, at least in terms of the way that I'm teaching it, they're approaching it. There's still growth. There's still areas for it to grow into it. Yeah. The students don't necessarily gravitate to that immediately, but those who get it, they're really passionate about it. Mm. They know, they get it, right? It requires a certain amount of, shall we say, mental focus or mental way to think about it a little bit differently.
Yeah.
It requires you as a person to really think about it. It's a different way to think about it. So
yeah, it seems like I guess especially the topic of data management. I know this is another area that is of interest to you. Where do you think data management is as a field in 2024?
That's a loaded question, isn't it?
That's a very loaded question. So yeah, just feel free to answer with a loaded answer.
And I said loaded question because no matter which side you fall, there's always somebody else who has something else, right? Let's look at applying management principles to data. When we were talking about earlier with data, data has a business exhaustion, as I was talking about earlier. One way I can approach it and look at it is, look, every business operations leaves its residue, meaning that for it to go from place, for you to deliver value to an entity, and I use the word entity here, it could be an end customer, it could be anybody, it could be an entity. To do that, it needs to go through a set of steps. And then as it moves through the set of steps, what it does is it leaves the contrails of data behind. Hey, mm-hmm. There's something somewhere here, something somewhere here. So there's elements of this data that kind of all the way flows through with it. Now, for you to make sense of it, for you to operate on it, for you to reason about it, gain insights from it, or whatever verbiage you want to apply to that, now you want to manage that, or you look at that across the board. And that's where, at a very conceptual level, we talk about data management. And then to do that effectively, you have different techniques, different frameworks, different approaches, different, for example, use data governance frameworks, discovery, metadata management, metadata. There's different elements to that that helps you to make sense of it, to tame it, to derive value from it. That's kind of the way that I look at data management as a whole. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that resonates or not, but that's kind of how I kind of, at least mentally, that's how I kind of think about that.
Yeah, I think the issue of data management in 2024 is it feels as a discipline that the data management community itself, it feels like it's been beating the same drum for a long time, and I'm not sure, you know, about how impactful it is versus the potential of what I think data management could be, you know, because I feel like it's just the same stuff over and over. Like we have to get more value from our data. We have to work with the business and bring them along for the data journey and all this stuff. And I'm like, we've been talking about the same crap for decades, and I don't know that we're any further along than we were in the past. So it kind of makes me wonder if the approach is wrong. And the other question is, is there a possibility with, you know, large language models or similar technologies to sort of, you know, at least help automate and scale data management past where it is? I think it's part of its messaging part where I think this is a business inherently just, it's, you know, the way data management is pitched, at least as far as I can tell and my experiences, I think it could be better. It could be more impactful. But then the execution part, right? It's very manual. At least the tools haven't, I don't think it catches up to where data is these days in terms of scale and size.
If you look at, as you've seen, the mad landscape, but there's like hundreds and thousands of tools that are out there that can do a lot of different variations of the same thing, right?
Yeah.
And you're right in the sense that it's a bit of like a deja vu. It's like, haven't I seen this before? Haven't I seen the same conversation happening? You kind of get to a point where you see, I know how this is going to go. I know how this conversation is going to go. Is the only thing different is the business, the people, the context is different, but it's the same pattern of problems that you see all the way through, right? But what is going to be interesting is the whole generative, which depends on data, which lives off of data, which its existence is off of a data-driven model, right? At the end of the day, that's what drives everything. Mm-hmm. Now, if the data itself, the underlying data itself, is not managed in a way that adds value up the food chain, then all you're doing is exasperating an existing situation which is now contained in any pockets. Now you're taking that and exploding it into a much larger sphere around that. So that's kind of one way to think. That's kind of what you're doing at some level. But if you manage it and if you know what you're doing in a controlled way, at least in the particular domain, then you can really reap a good, it's a huge step changes that are happening if you use it appropriately, if you leverage it in the way that you can get from that. But anyway, that's still up for discussion. We'll see. We don't know where the world is heading.
We certainly don't. I mean, when I was in Saudi Arabia recently, I was having breakfast with an AI doomsday person, right? And this, according to this person,
there are quite a few of them. Yeah,
there's a few of them. Yeah, this person was a researcher for AI safety, and I think I asked, so where do you think it's going? And he's like, well, in the next 5 years, we'll all be dead. So I was like, okay, so what are you doing to prepare for it? And he's like, well, there's nothing we can do. I'm like, cool. But what was interesting, you know, as an aside, is this person was also trying to figure out their travel plans for a tour and Saudi, and was very conscious about budget and time. And I was like, so if you think the world's ending in 5 years, personally, I would just be like, screw it. Money doesn't matter at this point. We're just going to go all out. So I thought that was an interesting observation.
It is. It's interesting when you say that, because I've had some of those conversations with some other folks. And interestingly enough, at an academic level or at a certain level, they all have a certain point of view, a fatalistic point of view, if you will, or a negative point of view, if you will. But then, does that actually translate to their actions, to their day-to-day existence? In a lot of cases, there is a disconnect between those two. It's almost like I feel that they have to have a certain story in the head that yeah. they say, oh, it's not going this way. But then, okay, if you truly believe in that, then your actions should reflect that. But I find a lot of people who talk about it, their actions don't reflect what they are saying.
Right.
There's a huge disconnect there.
Oh, it's a big one, right? It reminds me of like a lot of doomsday preppers who I know. I live in Utah, by the way, so there's a lot of them here. But, you know, it's the same thing where I'm just like, okay, I don't know. Very fatalistic point of view. But it's, yeah, the actions don't seem to reflect it. Like you're still, you're doing things that wouldn't indicate that you feel like the world's ending any second. So it's,
exactly. Exactly. Yeah,
that's fascinating. And what's interesting, I think, about the AI conversation is there's definitely a lot of impacts with AI on society. I mean, the way I see things kind of going downhill since we're on the thread is we just live in this giant bubble of misinformation and people just disconnect from everything and they stop believing everything. They stop learning, you sort of go back to maybe some form of the Dark Ages at some point, because if you live in this giant hole of mirrors where you have no idea what's real and what's not, your defense mechanism is going to be, well, I guess nothing's real. So what's the point?
It's the metaverse that we live in.
It really is. Like, well, this person at the same time, he's like, you know, we're all living in a simulation anyway. And I was like,
yeah,
sure, dude, it's like really early right now. apparently my first cup of coffee. So anyway. That's interesting.
It's funny. And one of the things that if you want to look for, if you're interested in a little bit, not a little interested, but I think one of the positiveness person that I look to and I listened to and I read about it is Dr. Fei-Fei Li. If you ever read the book, it's a book called The Worlds I See. I think it's a very heartwarming, it's a very positive thing about that, the nature of that, the way to look at it, the way to harness it, and how she talks about using and leveraging AI for health, for the benefit of, you know, and she has a very personal story that she talks to about that. So to me, when I hear about that, when I see that happening, things like that, it really, you know, gives me very positive nature that maybe things will turn out to be good.
I mean, we would hope so. I mean, and people like us, I guess we have a choice of whether, you know, we can convey that goodness and trying to teach that, the positive aspects, you know, to the people who listen to us, whether that's students or
exactly,
you know, our audiences versus, you know, I think, being doomsayers, I think it's easy to go down the negativity route. But I think you also become a victim of kind of your own far-fetched, ideas to the point where you have to start rationalizing it. And it's a doom loop that you get into. You see this with other people, right? I mean, like, you know, people who hoard gold and guns and stuff, you start rationalizing that behavior and often with some weird effects. But here we are with AI. I mean, I didn't think we'd be here this early, but, you know, and I didn't think that something like ChatGPT would be the catalyst for it, but here we are. So it's a chatbot. I don't know. It seems pretty innocuous when you think about it.
It's funny. I remember my first foray in this space was 28 years ago when I first, you know, pattern recognition using Lisp.
Oh, wow.
And using C++. And then there's like, you know, it's a simple pattern recognition thing that we needed to build. And that took reams and reams of, you know, shall we say, code, you know, thousands of lines of code to do one little thing. Now you just, it comes right out of the box. You just make a call out to that and you're done with it. And it's funny. I talk about those things in my class as well to give them a context of that, saying what you kind of take for granted. I hate to use the word take for granted because every generation takes a few things for granted, because you're living off of somebody else's work. Nobody can ever truly say, well, I did this all on my own. I mean, that's kind of
correct.
I'm allergic to that kind of statement. But that being said, the thing that I like to kind of talk to them is, look, what you're seeing here, you know, is to have a healthy respect for things that you leverage, things that you use, things that you don't take it for granted. Understand what went behind that so that you can build up on that as you grow in your career or as you grow in the things that you do, right? That's kind of what I like to, is how do you build up on things to make it better, not to kind of either use it for something else or kind of just talk about it in not understanding what went behind that.
Mm-hmm. What do your students think about that when you talk to them about this?
It's interesting. I would hope that they get it. I would hope that, you know, obviously, you know, you see a lot of head nods, or at least relative head nods, if you will, in the class. But, you know, but I do, you know, but there's a good section of those folks, the students at the end of the class, something clicks in them, and they come back and tell me, you know what, this helped me. Either during my interviews, or either during I was listening to somebody in this conference, or listening to this podcast, or whatever it is, and to me, if they come back and give me that kind of information, that is hugely, it helps me understand. Okay, you know what? I'm making a dent, a small, but you know, I'm making an impression on things as they grow into that. So to me, that's all I can hope for. At least I'm a very pragmatic person about these kinds of things. I'm not expecting that things are going to change dramatically or things I'm going to make that much of a big change. But enough small changes like these adds up is kind of the way I look at that.
Yeah. I guess that brings up a good question. Like, what do you wish you were taught back when you were getting started?
Critical thinking. Really, I mean, I don't necessarily mean that, you know, the principles of Aristotle or Plato, or it doesn't matter. That's one, it's culturally aligned to the Western world thing, but the Eastern world thing, you know, there's lots of, you know, things around it. But the ability, or at least the notion of really honing in on taking a particular statement or taking a particular concept and really breaking it apart, really taking it apart and looking at it from multiple angles. I mean, that's really, to me, the critical thinking is the most important thing, especially now as we are seeing the need for it. It's less about, one of the things I tell the students is, no longer is coding, our ability to code well is a superpower. You 20 years, 25, 30 years ago, that's what used to be, right? So you get a job, you get a good job at companies like Microsoft and others. You got to be really good in programming. You got to be really good at it. Then you got a job, right? That's kind of the shortcut way of saying that's kind of what really happened, right? Nowadays, I think going forward, I don't think that's going to be it. You really need to have a lot more than that. A business approach to thinking about it. What problem are we trying to solve? Do we really need to do this? And that's what I tried to tell them to do. As a data engineer, you're in this kind of a role in between, wherein you get people coming in from multiple different directions, from business folks, you know, from your engineering folks, from your software development. All these folks are going to come to you, and they all want to do things. But you always have to question everything that's being asked to do. You want to get this data? Question it. What kind of data? What service does this do? What business question is it answering? What is your key business question?
Yeah.
And is this data that you're asking me, and then you should question the data itself. Does it really answer the question that you're looking for, right? Is it fit for purpose? What is it being used for? And does it really answer the question that you think it is going to answer? So anyway, the critical thinking, that's why I said, it is so important to kind of have that.
It's super important. I think especially nowadays with LLMs and the fact that it produces a singular answer.
Yes.
I mean, that's going to be more and more important. I always tell my kids, like, the number one thing you got to develop is a good BS detector.
Yes, exactly.
But you got to know what BS looks like.
That's the thing, too. You need to know in order to discern from fact from fiction, as they say. Mm-hmm. But then again, one could make the argument, well, what is considered to be facts? What is considered to be that? So as things start to move around, you got to have certain core principles or core things that you need to have, and then can use that in a malleable way to help answer the things that you need to.
Oh, absolutely. And you bring up an interesting point earlier, you know, about coding and whatnot, right? That used to be the superpower back in the day. I mean, this week when we recorded, it was at Cognition AI, they just announced Devin, which is the full-fledged automated software engineer that, I guess supposedly can, do software projects end-to-end with some prompts. And, a demo is pretty cool. As with all these things, you never know what it's actually like until you try and use it. But, saying, that the demo is what it actually does, that's a pretty big breakthrough, right? Because it's interesting when you compare it to 10 years ago, even, and earlier, STEM and coding were the skills of the 21st century. And these are the things that, every student needed to learn how to code, right? I actually wrote an article back, I think it was 2013 or something like that, about it was during Obama's Code Week, I think it was. I think I called it Code Week, WEAK, because it was like, even back then, I was like, I don't think that everyone needs to learn how to code. I think that this is a bit of a strange notion that everyone needs to learn how to code. Like, maybe if your job requires it, sure. But for the most part, I think your critical thinking skills, being able to work the business, I think that's more of the skills I would hope people would learn. I think that's what the article said. But you kind of fast forward to today, and I think there's an existential question about, whether programming will even be a thing in the future, right? Or what the scope of that job's going to entail. And so, but it's fascinating. 10 years, fast forward 10 years from 2014, like, this is a discussion. But even like 3 years ago, before ChatGPT was out, this wasn't, I think Andre Kaparthy was talking about sort of code 2.0 and the fact that it's, could have software systems writing each other, but this wasn't a mainstream discussion yet.
Yeah, and he also said, I think, not fairly recently, but to say that English is the new programming language or something like that. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily saying it in those words, but I think that's what he was trying to get at.
Yeah.
Also, another interesting thing about that is, it's to me, when we talk about, when we say critical thinking, it's about the modular approach to looking at things. Meaning, if you can build this particular module, whatever that, I'm using the general term here, module, but I'm just saying that what are the kinds of building blocks that you can, well, it's not almost like a Lego set, right? I mean, hey, if I can design this piece over here, this piece over here, but the individual pieces of how those, that particular module, that particular service, or that particular thing works under the covers, leave it to your AI assistant or whatever it is to help you to develop that piece in the way that you define it to be. Yep. But then this is where the thing comes into it, right? Now, for you to know, okay, I need this in order to combine, combinatorially work with this in order to produce this final output or this final solution for a particular business problem or a particular thing. That means that you really need to know that. You really need to understand that, right? That's kind of where, that's where that is so important to kind of get to that mode of thinking.
One question I want to ask, and this, we both teach at universities, so this might be a controversial question. So feel free to punt on it if you'd like. But what do you see as a role of a university? In a day and age when seemingly any amount of knowledge can be synthesized out of thin air, and there's a variety of ways you can learn things online, YouTube, MOOCs, and so forth. Like, what does a university provide? From a technical learning angle for technical students in 2024 and beyond?
To me, the ROI on universities and the value that universities are providing is, to me personally, it is undergoing a fundamental rethinking. From a student perspective, right? If you consider students as your customer, right?
Yep.
I got a teenage boy who is heading into university later this year, right? Later this year. So one of the conversations that we end up having is, okay, this school costs this costs this. It all comes down to that to a certain extent, and the quality and the value you're going to get out of that, right? in, you know, he wants to major in finance. So he's looking at it from that, from a finance perspective and saying, hey, you know, what is the ROI on this? So it's just really good to hear the kids these days thinking along those lines. In our days, where we were growing up, we were like, hey, get into a good place, just do that, it'll be fine, right?
Back in those days, a degree cost next to nothing.
Exactly. You didn't think about it. You didn't think like you had to literally, you know, hundreds and thousands of dollars these days.
I looked at some stubs recently of my tuition I paid at University of Utah, and I think my entire semester costs as much as a credit these days.
Yes, it's insane. Exactly, it is. So when you're looking at that kind of thing, it's a natural thing for going to be like, is it really worth it for me? Like, what is it that is providing? What additional value is it providing that I would not get if I were to go to? I'm not saying it's going to happen anytime. Maybe it is, maybe it already is in certain ways. Use this AI bot to teach me this particular topic, right? Like Khan Mingo, Khan Academy, and they're really leveraging it and using it and applying it to schools. And from what I'm hearing about it, they're getting some really great feedback from that. So they're using that as an aid to the teacher to help them accelerate, personalize, especially on the personalization side of it. Think that's going to be the key to it. So university is, you know, is not going to go away, but it is going to take on a very different form. I think personalization is going to be a key part of it. Scaled personalization is kind of the way I look at that as. So how do you do that? So it's not just going to be like a broadcast. You stand in front of a thing and then you talk, you lecture, and then you. To me, that is still will continue to be there, but I think it's going to morph and change quite dramatically. That's kind of where I see that happening. Because remember, in those days, you used to come in, right? It's not like you couldn't bring you didn't have a laptop, you didn't have anything. These days, you go into any classroom, everybody has a laptop, right? Yep. That's a given thing. That's been going on for a while. So going forward, how do you think that's going to change, right? Hey, I got my little, you know, everybody gets the phone. I got my little bot here next to me telling me, you know, recording what I'm saying. I'm just making it up as I'm going along. But things that could help with them. And then a lot of the other things comes along with it, along to the point of saying they're going to question more of the whoever it is who is talking to them, who is teaching them, right? There's going to be more of that kind of I'm not just going to sit back and listen to what you're saying. I'm going to actually question you as well. Because here's the additional information that I got from this whatever other thing that I'm right here with me. So tell me, explain to me what holds that different. So the bar, I think, goes up quite a bit.
For sure. I mean, I think when you and I were in college, I'm guessing we're about the same age, thereabouts old at this point. Like, you know, especially when you're an undergrad and your first, you know, a freshman, sophomore year, you're often in lecture halls that are hundreds or maybe 1,000 students in there, right? And so these are kind of the feeder classes, you know, some of the weed out classes. But there was too many students for even the TAs to give personalized attention to. I mean, I remember being a TA and I was like, this job, I'm doing the best I can. I'm not going to get to everybody, you know, and that's kind of how it is. But yeah, the personalization, I think, is a wonderful aspect of where that could go at scale, because it's something students never had. In fact, you know, I always tell my kids, if you have to, if it comes to it, go to a community college for a lot of your generals. I mean, do it while you're in high school, because the classes are basically the same anyway. It's not like you're going to get, in fact, it's probably better because you have a smaller class, you know, so and you're going to pay about a fraction of what you do at the big university. We're going to charge you an arm and a leg plus books and all the other crap for what experience at the end of the day. Like, you get to be in a crowded lecture hall and have to figure out on your own. So
yeah, time will tell, right? But it is going to change, but it is fundamentally changing, as we all know that. So.
Yeah. It's kind of closing out. Like, what are you excited about? You know, kind of zooming out, we're in a, I think, a very fascinating time in the data and tech field right now. Like, what do you, what stokes you?
I'm both excited and concerned, right? Let me, just because there's so much information, so much, again, information, the word misinformation is also used, but then at the end of the day, it's information to the person who's consuming it. And if you're not able to discern one from the other, then what does that mean? What is the concept of a common truth, if you will, or a common, not even truth, let me take it back, a common concept that we all agree to, right? Or a common whatever that we all agree to. If that goes away, if that starts to, it's already fracturing, that starts to fracture more and more. Yeah. And if technology is kind of accelerating that fracture more and more, then what is going to replace that? What is going to take its place? Mm. How are we going to kind of tether ourselves in ways towards a common goal, whatever that quote unquote common goal is, right? Is there a common goal that we don't destroy each other? Is that like a fundamental common goal you want to go with?
Pretty sad common goal if that's what it is.
So that's what I'm saying. So there is the concern part of it, and then there is the positive of it where, you know what, maybe we'll all elevate ourselves to a higher mode of thinking or whatever you want to call it, right? So it's just that it can play multiple roles. Technology can play multiple roles of that.
Oh, yeah.
So we'll see. We'll see. Time will tell. But we definitely are. But I definitely want to do everything in my power, whatever little that I have, right? In terms of whatever little area in which I can make a difference, I'd like to make a positive difference and try to at least infuse that. At least as we go forward.
Oh yeah, yeah, for sure. And that's all you can do. I mean,
that's exactly. That's all you can do. Yeah.
If you look at your circle of control, as Stephen Covey puts it, there's a lot of things you could be worried about. There's things you can control, and you know, I kind of have the feeling that a lot of in-person stuff is going to come back, for the very reason people are going to seek out their tribe. You know,
Yeah, I'm sure you've read Yuval Noah Harari's book, right?
Yep.
About
Sapiens.
Sapiens. All that. I mean, it all comes down to the old tribal, right? That tribalism is still runs. It's part of our DNA. It's part of who we are. It's part of where we operate. So
that's why we meet in person, right?
Exactly.
We were at a conference a couple months ago, and there, lo and behold, people there. Like, you didn't have to do that. You could theoretically do it on a Zoom call, but the impact is, I would say, not as great. So
exactly. Yeah.
Well, great chatting with you, Kishore. For people who want to learn more about you, how can they do that?
Well, they can follow me on LinkedIn. That's probably the best way to do that. I'm available on it. I post, as much as I can, the information that I can do with it. So that is the most, shall we say, the sane way right now of connecting with things.
Awesome. Yeah. I'll put the LinkedIn in the show notes. Well, it's good chatting with you, man. We'll see you around. If you ever need me to lecture your class again, happy to come by. So
great. Yeah, we'll definitely have you over then.
Awesome. Right. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Okay.